In that case, we are going to go directly to our speaker, who is Danielle W. from Orchid.
All right.
Hello. Uh-oh, this isn't going to fit here. I'm Danielle. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Danielle.
Lynn called me, and I was driving through L.A. traffic. My husband and I were taking my daughter back to her new apartment at college and asked me to speak tonight, and I couldn't think quick enough. So all I could think of to say was yes. But so here I am, and my sobriety date is January 19th, 2001. So the newcomers don't have to get out their fingers. That's 17 years, 7 months, and 6 days. And I did that by coming to meetings and basically doing what I was told to do. What it was like, I grew up with Ozzy and Harriet. My mom and dad got married when they were 17, 18, and I was born shortly after that. And they were happy, and alcohol wasn't an issue in our home, or drinking wasn't an issue. They always, it was 5 o'clock, it was happy hour, and they'd have a drink. And sometimes a second drink, and then they'd drink milk with dinner, and that was it. Unless, you know, we were at the lake or other things where you could drink during the day, legally. And I never saw my parents drink. I never saw my parents fight. They're married 60 years next year. They're still happy. And the one thing in my home was it was very much what it matters what people think. And I was raised in a home where it mattered what people thought. And my mom was like cheerleader, homecoming queen. And so I, of course, wanted to be or was required to be the cheerleader. And I didn't make homecoming queen. That's another story I might get to. But I wanted to fit in. I wanted to hang with the popular kids. And the popular kids went out Friday and Saturday night, and they went to parties, and they drank. And so that was really my first experience drinking, was Friday or Saturday night, and we'd go out. And I remember my mom buying it for me. She wouldn't pay for it. We'd have to, everybody pitched in 50 cents, and we had $2. I gave it to my mom, and she'd buy a bottle of Tickled Pink. And four of us would hop in my 56 Chevy, drive through McDonald's, get 7-Up, fill the rest with Tickle Pink, and that was it. And I don't ever remember, you know, in all my drinking, I drank till I was 40. I never blacked out. I threw up quite a bit, mostly in the mornings, but I wasn't a blackout drinker. When I look back now, you know, well, I'm going to jump around too much here, though. But drinking worked for me, and it wasn't daily. It was if everybody was drinking or if we were at a party or whatever. I know I was drinking at cocktail hour long before I was 21. I was about 19, and I was in Bakersfield at a bar or a place that they also had dancing. And I remember looking down the dance floor, and there was this ID. And this girl was over 21. She was 5'6", blonde hair, blue eyes, and it was like a gift from God. And I grabbed that ID, and I used that till I was 21, so that was never a problem. I moved out when I was 19 to go to college, and just from the day I left, if at 5 o'clock I'd have a drink. And then I'd have a second, and then a third. You know, and for a million reasons, I didn't think I was an alcoholic, and I certainly wasn't as bad as you people were, with all the stories I heard when I got here. But, you know, as I hung around a while, I started to think about, I gotta lose these shoes. Sorry. And I never, ever remember having just one. I never had a drink like my parents and then stopped. Or two drinks and then stopped. And if there was like a daytime event or a daytime wedding where we drank at noon, I'd get home and didn't want more, but I still wouldn't stop till I go to bed. From the moment I started drinking, out on my own at 19, I'd have a cocktail, it's happy hour, that's normal, that's what I was taught in my home, that's what they did. But I had another, I sipped away until I went to bed, and I don't remember ever having one or two or stopping. And so I went through college and got a job, got into a really nice career that I loved. All I ever wanted was to get married and have babies. And I knew if I could get married and have babies, my life would be perfect. And for me, it really, it was, which is why it makes no sense that that's when my drinking took off. But I didn't meet my husband. Well, I met my husband in college, but we didn't date back then. Ran into each other again. I didn't meet him until I was 33. And so, that was a lot of years of just wishing and getting in the wrong relationships and getting engaged to an alcoholic, of course, because he was worse than me. You know, I didn't have to think about it. You know, in the back of my mind, it was like, if I don't quit drinking this much, I'm going to end up going to those meetings. And I had an uncle that was an alcoholic, and he was a bad one. And he was always having to go to meetings, although he never did get sober. He died of this disease. And so I knew about AA and I knew about the meetings because of this uncle. And I'd wake up every morning with a headache and sick to my stomach and think, I need to stop drinking every day because I hate feeling like this every morning. But, you know, I wouldn't drink at work. It still worked for me for a long time. I met my husband and had a baby. Actually, I was overdue on our first anniversary, so I was, you know, I turned 35 on our honeymoon, so I didn't have a lot of time to waste. But and I thought I was going to dump her in daycare like everybody else did and go back to work in, you know, 12 weeks. And I did, and I hated it. And all I wanted to do was be home with her. And it was horrible to be dropping her off. And so my husband got offered a job over here. We were living in Fresno. That's where we met, Fresno State. And got married and stayed there. He was born there. He got offered a job over here. And it offered us the ability for me to stay home with her. And so now we move over here, bought a nice house. And I remember thinking that, you know, when I get over there, I'm going to change this habit. I'm not going to drink every night, and I'm not going to drink so much that when we get to this new place, I can change a habit, because now all my dreams have come true, and I'm sick of having a hangover in the morning. And so now we're over here. I'm a stay-home mom. I'm married to this great guy, tall, dark, and handsome, and we get along great, and that's when my drinking takes off. And it made no sense to me, because that's when everything I ever wanted came to me. And I remember thoughts like, well, I know I'm not an alcoholic because I don't drink in the morning. And I know I'm not an alcoholic because I don't hide it. And, you know, all these rules that if I was an alcoholic, I'd have to blackout. I didn't black out. I'd have to, you know, hide it. And I'm not doing any of those things. Then I got pregnant with twins, and now I'm 39 years old with twins. And as soon as they got out of my body, I mean, I had vodka in my suitcase when I left for the hospital to go have them. And I even remember, like, on the second night, he had gone home with the two-year-old, and the nurses had taken the babies to the nursery, and I realized I don't have any alcohol left. And I even remember calling him and begging him to wake up the two-year-old and bring me some wine in the hospital. And, oh my gosh. So I ended up hiding it. I ended up drinking in the morning. And, you know, it just got so bad that I was nursing these twins, and they'd get up in the middle of the night to drink. And so I'd pour a drink, and I mean to eat. They'd get up to eat, and I'd pour a drink. It's like, hey, it's middle of the night. If I got to get up, let's make it a party. Plus, that'll help me go back to sleep. And so then I even got smart, because they'd cry too much if it took me too long to get ready to feed them, and that would wake him up. So I'd make my drink before I put him down for the night, and it was in the fridge ready to go. So they'd wake up, grab my drink, and I'd, you know, nurse him. And my son, he was the one that still was getting up at night after 6 weeks. He'd get up at 3 or 4 in the morning to nurse, and I'd have my drink, and I'd go back to sleep. He'd go back to sleep. It was fine. And then he was like 11 weeks old, and he started sleeping through the night. Well, I'm still waking up at 3, 4 in the morning, and I'm shaking. I got to have a drink to stop the shaking so that I can go back to bed. And that was, you know, when I realized how bad it was. And then my liver, I forget what my symptoms were, but I'd seen the doctor, and my liver, you have some number that's supposed to be under 30 for a healthy liver, and it was way elevated. And the doctor wants to start doing all these tests, and I knew what it was. I had a deformity in my spine that had been causing me horrible pain, whole nother story, and that progressively got worse until I had a new titanium spine put in, and now I can stand here and talk to you pain-free. Thank you, God. But I was taking tons of Tylenol and drinking around the clock and taking Tylenol around the clock. And you're not supposed to mix those two, by the way. They say that. And it was shutting down my liver. And then in January of 01, I went to a dentist appointment for the beginning of a root canal. And this machine broke down, so they had to wait, and they had to move me to another room. And anyhow, long story short, I was there like 4 hours, and when I got done, I was shaking so bad that I couldn't write the check to them. And so I started having these panic attacks, because I thought, I knew I was gonna die, and I didn't know how to stop. And if I was awake, I was drinking. You know, I don't have the DUIs, the blackouts, the jail, all the other stories to give you, but I was very seriously ill with alcoholism, and I didn't know how to stop. And I told my husband, I had another panic attack. My uncle, during this 2-week period too, the dentist was the first thing. I got a call that my uncle got put in ICU to die of alcoholism. And then I got a call that a dear, dear friend of mine from college, who was an alcoholic, and I always knew that, had tried everything to get sober, and his solution was to shoot himself with a shotgun. And he died, and that was like the third straw, and my panic attacks turned on. And finally I told my husband, I need help. I don't know how to stop. I drink too much. And I thought he would say, no, you don't. You know, you don't drink that much, and you're not that, you know. And he said, what shocked me, he said, I know. And so we called my sister, who had about 15 years of recovery at the time, and I went down to Cottage and detoxed, and then they highly encouraged me to stay for a 30-day program. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to. I had 3 babies at home in diapers, and nobody could handle them except me. Apparently, I didn't handle them that well, but I thought I did. And so my husband says, just do 2 weeks, you know. What I didn't know is he had already paid for the whole 30 days. And when I got to the 2 weeks, I called him in, and I said, I started getting scared. I realized this was going to be hard. And I said, I want to stay 2 more weeks. And he's like, I already paid for it. I was staying 30 days, it turned out. So I did that program, and there was a group of 20 of us, and those statistics you always, you know, hear, that 1 out of 10 will make it, 1 out of 10 will make it. And, you know, 3 years after that program, there was 2 out of the 20 of us that were still sober. And we really thought we were different, because, you know, 1 in 10, that's just the people that walk into meetings and try to do it themselves. But we've had all this therapy and art therapy and leather therapy. And, you know, we've had all this training, and they've drug us around. Billy used to come with the druggy buggy and pick us up. That's, I met Billy in rehab, and he kept bringing the druggy buggy over and pick us up and take us to meetings a couple times a day. And, you know, with all these papers they'd had us fill out and read and all this stuff, we were going to beat that 1 in 10 thing. And we didn't. And, you know, at first when I got there, I was talking to the gal, and I said, I need a private room. And I had all my reasons, because, you know, all my squaddlers in diapers were going to be visiting, and my husband had to come visit. And she's like, honey, you know, I can see you're a little high maintenance, so we'll give you a private room. And I was just took offense to, what do you mean I'm high maintenance? And so they gave me a private room as long as they could. And then one night at midnight, this gal comes in, and this is your new roommate. She had just gotten released from jail. And she was rough looking, and she had all these tattoos, and straight from jail. And I was still sitting there figuring out how I was different than those people in AA. And I just didn't want to die, you know. I didn't want to die, and I was. I'm going to jump back a minute here. When I checked into the hospital, this little liver number that's supposed to be under 30, well, at 180, you're supposed to be in a coma, and at 200, you should be dead. And mine kicked in at 230, and the nurse told my husband, I can't believe she's walking and awake. And I was very coherent. I mean, we stopped at, my life was manageable at that time, I thought. And, but I was definitely days from death. And that was very scary. And so I didn't want to die, and I didn't want to leave my kids and my husband. And so I was going to figure out this thing and how to not drink, at least for a while, and at least not so much. And so this gal, her name was Becky, I think. And there was all these reasons how she was different than me. And she was. Her whole life story, her drink, everything was. But man, we bonded, and we shared the disease of alcoholism. And we became really good friends. And when we got out, she relapsed. And then she'd call me, and I'd be like, well, are you doing what they said to do? Are you going to meetings? Do you have a sponsor? Well, no, but I'll do that now. And, you know, then she relapsed again. And I remember her saying to me on the phone, she goes, you know, they said 1 in 10 would make it. I guess you were the lucky one. And I just remember how angry that made me. I thought, this isn't a freaking raffle. If it's a raffle, I would have won, because I do. And that's why most of you hate me. If there's a raffle involved, because I do. I win raffles all the time. It's sick. It's a disease I have, but I'm not trying to cure it. But she said I was the lucky one, as if this was, you know, draw straws or something. And I remember calling her back after I thought that through, and I said, you know, I'm not lucky. This isn't a luck thing. I'm not chosen by God to be the one. I said, I'm doing what they told us to do. When we were in rehab, they told me to go to a meeting every day, and at least 90 meetings in 90 days, which was my plan. And I did. And they told me when you get home, to get a sponsor. And I did. And they said, if you feel like drinking, call somebody first. And I did. work the steps, you know, all the things they told me to do. I was doing those things. And I still do the same things 17 years, 7 months, and 6 days later that I did in the first 90 days. And I am going to keep doing them because I like the results. You know, I like the results produced by Alcoholics Anonymous and the growth. And so anyhow, next thing I heard from Becky was she died. She drank too much and apparently was in some guy's car that she met at a bar that wasn't her husband. And he thought she passed out. Turns out she just died of alcohol poisoning, and he pulled over and pushed her out of the car because he didn't want to get, you know, we pick really good people to hang around with when we're in the throes of alcoholism. And he put her out of the car and drove away, and they found her body. And I think he got charged with illegal disposal of a corpse. And that was all because she, you know, he didn't kill her. She just died of this disease. And I remember I'd call my counselor from the rehab every time somebody would go out or when Becky died. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do? This is, upsets me so much. And I'm, you know, when they go out and these are my friends and we're, you know, and she's like, all you can do, honey, just say better her than me, better her than me. And it sounds cold, but, you know, that was all the part of sticking with the winners. You know, if I quit doing what I paid them $10,000 to tell me, and I could save you all a lot of money if you haven't been to rehab, get a big book and go to meetings. All the solutions are there. But it was definitely the best money we ever spent because, you know, if I was a bar drinker or hung around with friends of the park drinker, you know, I could quit going to the bars or quit hanging around with those people. I drank at home. You know, my home with my three little triggers was my bar. And so the best thing that happened to me was to be removed from my drinking environment for 30 days and get some clarity and get some instructions. And so let's see, where are we now? I really didn't want to quit forever. That wasn't on my mind in the early days. I, like I had said, it was about not drinking so much, and I wanted to not drink and get my health back, which turns out our bodies are pretty miraculous. My liver was 20 or 21, 30 days after I quit. You know, just boom, your body takes care of that. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to learn to drink like a lady, I think. And, you know, or just drink wine on the weekend, a glass of wine with dinner, or just, you know, that was my goal, was to just have a glass and not drink alcoholically, you know. And luckily I hung around here and I kept coming back. And, you know, I think after those 90 days, I loved going to meetings, but some of it was, I was a stay-home mom with these three little, you know, scrawdlers. And if I left for a meeting, I got like an hour and a half, 2 hours of no kids. And so, you know, my motivation may have been not 100%, but I had no problem leaving that house at 7:30 and heading to a meeting every night. And God bless my husband. He never complained, and he always made it easy for me to go. And that was really key. You know, now I mostly go to daytime meetings. Still a stay-home mom, but now that I've got two teenagers. The twins are in college, their second year, and my oldest is doing her graduate work. You know, so they're kind of gone now. And so I started filling my time with some volunteer work. I went through the all, oh, my babies are gone. So I heard they needed people in the NICU at Marion to cuddle babies. Sign me up, and that's what I do twice a week now, and I love it. But So I kept going to meetings. I was still looking for the differences, you know, and there were a lot of differences. And, you know, finally someone told me to look for the similarities. And as soon as I quit, you know, thinking I was different, you know, I was taller, I was more educated, or actually shorter back then, just whatever, I was different, you know, I didn't have the same horrible stories, you know. But when I started looking for the similarities, I saw them. And, you know, it took the obsession, the cravings to drink left rather quickly for me, but the obsession didn't. The obsession lingered around for 2.5 years, and where I was still thinking, not thinking I want to drink, thinking that I'm not drinking. You know, I'm having my nails done and I'm not drinking. I'm walking through the grocery store and I'm not drinking, and I'm not buying wine at the grocery store. And I'm, you know, driving to get my hair done and I'm not drinking. You know, normal times that everyone would be drinking, right? At the grocery store and a manicure and your hair appointment. Of course, that's normal time. But I was still constantly thinking about how I wasn't drinking. And by, you know, after about 9 months, I was okay. My husband took all the alcohol out of the house. God bless him. And he's a normie. He comes home from work and he drinks a drink, you know, or he has a glass of wine. And he says, no, I don't want another, because then I'll get too tired and I have some things I need to do. You know, I've just chosen that instead of ever thinking, I wish I could drink like him, he's just a daily reminder to me that I don't drink like that. I never just have one. I don't remember ever having one. So the obsession didn't leave right away. And so I knew if there was an open bottle in the fridge, or, you know, I let him keep beer in the house. I never liked beer anyways, and it didn't bother me. But then I started letting him bring back the things that I liked. Although, switch gears a little bit, I still am not comfortable having vodka in my house, which is really odd to me, because I don't think about drinking anymore. It's you know, after a certain number of years, it becomes normal not to drink. You know, I don't think about, I wonder if they'll have alcohol at this baby shower, or I wonder if they'll have alcohol at this wedding, or you know, we're going to a winemaker dinner, which we still had to do all the time. My husband was in the wine business, and so I was still around it. And, you know, my prayer was that I would, like the big book says, I would get to that place of neutrality where I, you know, I don't care if people are serving it. I don't care if it's in my home. I serve it in my home. That's just, for me, it works. But I'm like the big book says, you know, I recoil as if from a hot flame. And with no doing of my own, it's just removed. That's what the big book tells us. And I remember the day that I realized it was removed. I always, you know, for those first 2.5 years before the obsession left, I knew who was drinking and how much they were drinking, and where it was in the house and how much of it there was. And, you know, this obsession thing was there. And I went to a women's AA retreat and I made an appointment to talk to the father. And anyhow, he suggested I go to this healing service, which I was going to anyways, but I was going to go for my back. But he's like, have you prayed honestly and asked God to remove that? So I did. I asked for prayer. They laid hands on me, and I wanted that obsession to go away because the craving was gone. But I was sick of thinking about alcohol constantly and the fact that I wasn't drinking it, not even wanting to, just thinking about, I don't drink, you know. And so they did. And I didn't like see any burning bush or anything. But about a week later, I was unloading the dishwasher, and a couple of my friends from Fresno had come over and stayed the night. And I'm unloading the dishwasher, and there's 3 wine glasses. And I had no recollection of anyone drinking wine the night before. And that's when I just knew that God had answered my prayer and it was removed.
I asked my husband, are you guys drinking wine? He's like, yeah, we drank two bottles. I didn't see anybody open it, pour it, drink it, and I was at the same table. And I'm really grateful that that obsession went away. And I think the other thing was that really helped me during those first 2.5 years before the obsession went away, and in the early days when I was still craving it, was the one day at a time. And I had heard that a million times in my life. It was some old AA slogan, and I remember looking at thinking, those people need a new slogan. That they've all been using the same bumper stickers for years, you know. They need some more updated slogan. And that slogan ended up being really what saved my life, because I didn't have intentions of never drinking again. And when I would get too far, any of us get too far ahead, like, oh my God, how will I make it through our trip to the lake? And how will I make it through New Year's Eve? And how will I make it through whatever, fill in the blank? That just seems so hard. And we're worried about it a whole year ahead of time. You know, on January 2nd, we're worried about how are we going to not drink on New Year's Eve of the, well, I got sober in January of the year after that. And the just really reading and hearing and meditating on one day at a time saved me, because I can do for a day quite easily what I don't even want to try to do for a week or a year, or for sure not the rest of my life, you know. So the good news of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we don't come in here and say we're never going to drink again. You know, that doesn't how it works. We just say we're not going to drink today. And as long as I could just not drink today, the tomorrows would take care of themselves. And I got to put quite a few 24 hours together. Part of my, the other thing was, when I got here, is everybody talked about relapse. Even in rehab, they made us do a relapse prevention plan. And everybody talked about when they relapsed, and so it relapsed. And so I just assumed, you know, I would, because everybody talked about it. And I remember thinking, if I'm going to relapse, I need to do it before I get my year chip, because that would suck to have to give back my 1 year chip, you know. And then I was like, I better do it before I hit 5 years, because I don't want to go back to it. 30 days when I thought, you know, in my head, I'm thinking that's normal. And then I heard it wasn't old timer Barry, because I think if I remember right, he was a relapser. Maybe, I think it was him. But he said something very profound, I thought. He said, relapse doesn't have to be part of your story, you know. And then I started paying attention to the people that didn't relapse. And they still belonged here, and they still got to stay. And, you know, for me so far, for 17 years, 7 months and 6 days, yes, I had to get out the calendar and figure that out this afternoon while I was thinking about it. But relapse isn't a part of my story. And that amazes me, because I like to drink. We had a drinking lifestyle socially for everybody else, but for me, you know, I never waited till we got to the winemaker dinner to drink. I was drinking in the afternoon or getting ready until the point that I was drinking around the clock. So, you know, the reason I share that, you know, I didn't have the DUI, I didn't black out, I haven't had to relapse, isn't for any other reason except that maybe that's somebody's story in here. And if you're still sitting here looking for the differences, that was, the similarities are a lot more important to look for, because there's a lot of them. I had lost my train of thought here. I remember while I was sitting looking at the differences and chalking them all up, I remember a gal got up when they took us to, in the druggy buggy to a Friday night speaker meeting in rehab, and they called it the Gucci meeting. And I went there and took a cake a few times after that. But this gal got up and she looked pretty clean because she was actually even blonde hair and blue eyes. And she was the boss's wife and she hid it and she never got the DUI and she never relapsed. And it was, she was me, you know, she was telling my story. And so all of a sudden it was like, oh, now I can relate, because everybody else's stories were, you know, jail and DUIs and, you know, murder, whatever, but they were different than mine. And so that really keyed me in those first 30 days when she got up and she told my exact story. I was amazed. And I knew that, you know, I was right where I belonged and I needed to stay here. And that's why I share, you know, some of those things, because I never know if someone's sitting around that's thinking, you know, I don't belong here because they all black out, or that, you know what I'm trying to get at. But, you know, I've had the privilege of raising my kids sober, and I'm so grateful for that. I drank when they, you know, they were in diapers, like I said, but they don't remember me ever drinking. And in fact, I was asked to speak about a year ago, maybe two now, I don't know. My twins were still living at home. And I said, my son, we were sitting at the dinner table, and he said, where are you guys going? And he said, my husband says, we're going to a speaker meeting. Mom's going to be the speaker. And they, by this time, know that I go to AA and that, you know, I'm an alcoholic and I don't drink anymore. And so anyhow, Mom's been asked to speak at an AA meeting. And my son goes, you don't drink. What the hell are you going to talk about? Why would they want you to speak at an AA meeting? You don't even drink. You don't know what you're talking about. And I was like, wow, okay, that's true. I know a lot, like, what I'm talking about. And I don't want to go back there. You know, I thought, I was thinking earlier, and I'm glad it came back to me, that the first step, that our lives had become unmanageable, we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable, couldn't relate at all to that. I knew I was powerless over alcohol, but my life was very manageable. You know, I had all the kids dressed, matching, the bows matched the socks, we were never late to church, you know, the house was clean most of the time. I had a housekeeper, but it was clean, and the bills were all paid on time. You know, I was very functional, and so I couldn't relate to that at all. But I was at a meeting, and a gal that was reading the steps was a little bit illiterate, and she read it as, we were powerless over alcohol, and our lives had become unimaginable. And I was like, okay, I can relate to that. I'm going to go with that for now, you know, for the step one. But one of the things I did in the early days is kind of wrote out my step one. And writing out, I think my sponsor at the time, or maybe it was a rehab, said, write about what your drinking was like, you know. I ran all over town with three babies in car seats, buying liquor at different stores so the checker wouldn't know how much I was buying. And drinking and driving with three car seats on a daily basis without fail. And in the morning, getting up at 3 a.m, shaking, having drinks, so I can go back to sleep. In the morning, I was so sick. I would wake up and I would start throwing up, and I would grab vodka and I'd sip it and throw up and sip it and throw up and look in the mirror and realize how much I hated myself until I could keep enough down to stop the throwing up. And then I was fine. I just finished, you know, the rest of my screwdriver and went on my day. And, you know, those things, you get those things on paper. And now all of a sudden you do feel as bad as those people, you know. I have a lot of yets, I told you, you know. I remember I used to get offended if someone said I was a high bottom, because I would read that paper of the things I was doing and how gross it was, and I felt like it was pretty low. you know. So so then I was able to go with the unmanageable, and I realized it was. And excuse me, I'm losing my voice again. So today I still go to almost always three meetings a week. On a bad week, I'll go to one, and that one happens to be in my home on Monday mornings. So I can't miss that one. And, you know, I still work with newcomers. I go to meetings that my sponsor's at, so I see her regularly. I don't call her enough, but some of that's just because I can think it through, and I know what she's going to tell me, so I don't have, oh yeah, that's what she's going to tell me, so why don't I just straighten this up? And I still, you know, I read my book. I still just do it a day at a time, and that a day at a time, this whole program has helped me in so many areas of my life. I'm such a better person than I was. There's another member of the program that says something that I always steal, is that Alcoholics Anonymous makes me a better person than I am. You know, my character defects are down there, and they're pretty far down there, and most of the time I can keep them out of the way. Some of them have been removed, but, you know, they can pop up again, and I don't like when that happens. And the more I'm going to meetings and staying with the principles of this program, the more that those don't come up. You know, one of my greatest, one of the greatest gifts AA has given to me is the ability to bite my lip most of the time. You know, I would say 95% plus of the time, what I'm thinking in here doesn't come out here. And I'm grateful for that. You know, I might write an email real quick in the moment, but I know not to send it. And I read it again the next morning, and I change it, and I still don't send it. And, you know, on the third day, it's a totally different email. I've deleted everything and written it different, and then I send it. You know, and that's just that ability. That's always been my husband's life motto. And I've tried to live by it, and I love it, and so I use it as mine all the time and have for quite a few years, is never pass up an opportunity to say nothing. And that works a lot for me. I don't, most of my amends when I got here, I hadn't, you know, done a lot of stealing or murdering or, you know, really bad, I don't know, that kind of stuff. Most of my amends were because of my mouth. You know, ways I had behaved or talked or said. And so if I try to practice that and never pass up an opportunity to keep my mouth shut, you know, I can go along pretty good at it. And, you know, we're almost done here. I didn't think I could talk for 45 minutes. I was like, they're getting out of here early today. I can only talk for 45 minutes if they got a 5-minute timer here, you know, then. But I went to my 40th high school reunion last Saturday night. And I ran into a gal who was never on my amends list. And I hadn't thought a whole lot about her, but her and this other gal had been really good friends. We met in sixth grade. I was the new kid to town in the summer of sixth grade. So we went all through sixth grade together, seventh and eighth. And then at high school, I didn't hang around with them because they weren't in the popular crowd. I don't know what crowd they were in, but I made a beeline for the jocks and the cheerleaders, and that was, you know, my mission. And I'm sitting there talking to this gal, Diane, and it just occurs to me, God, do I owe her an amends? You know, I know that her and another girl were really good friends, and I don't ever have recollections of hanging around with them in high school at all. I don't think I was ever mean to her, but I just had this uncomfortable feeling from Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just said, Diane, I just, you know, I don't remember any bad stuff between us in high school, but I also remember that we didn't hang around. And I go, I want to apologize, you know, if I just, you know, left you in the dust because I was going for the, you know, starting lineup and the cheerleading team. And so I made amends to her. And she was like, no, there was never anything like that. And no, you're too sweet. You don't have to do that stuff. But you know what? I felt better. You know, she never was on my resentment list. She was never on my amends list. It's never come up in my head till I was sitting right there with her. You know, and that's the beauty of this program. More will be revealed. And then someone did come back to me and he wasn't there. Someone that I was mean to, that I would love to run into Billy Beam sometime and make amends, because I know I was mean and snotty to that kid. And, you know, he was probably bullied too. But anyhow, I just, you know, I still, you know, at first, it's like this program for me is the opposite of the way that drinking was. You know, in the beginning, I drank because I wanted to. And then I drank because it had become a habit. And then I drank because I had to, you know. So with this program and meeting specifically, it's the opposite of that. At first I went because I had to, and then I went because it had become a habit. And now I go because I want to. And I hope I never quit. I ever don't want to go to AA and don't want to keep doing this work, because I like, you know, what AA has produced in me. I like the gifts of the program, and I don't ever want to go back. I have a lot of yets. I'm still married to the same guy, you know, 23 years later, and I thought we were real happy those first 6 years, and when I was in rehab, I kind of, in therapy, found out he wasn't as happy as I thought he was, and that was shocking and very upsetting to me, you know, and now we're really happy. He's been in Al-Anon for 10 years, and that works good. And so, you know, if you're new, welcome, and just keep coming back. It sounds, there's another old slang, I keep coming back, but it's true. I go when I don't want to go, and I can go with, you know, all twisted up in knots. I used to say I was all tweaked out, because that's what we said back then. Now that's a word for a new drug, and so I can't say I'm tweaked anymore. But I can go all wound up to a meeting, and I will leave that meeting a different person with a different attitude. I'll just hear something. But, you know, for me, it's impossible to leave a meeting and feel as icky as I felt going into it. Just never happens. And so I hope you guys will do this thing one day at a time, and I hope you keep coming back. And that's all. Thank you.
All right, let's get Danielle. Danielle.